Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the show. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Good Monday morning to you. Glad you can join us. Coming up, the state has some extra money coming in. What might it do with that cash?
And some grim water news for Pinal County.
But first, Maricopa County Assessor Paul Peterson is now in the custody of federal authorities. He was turned over on Friday in the wake of dozens of felony charges he now faces in Arizona, Utah, and Arkansas. The charges stem from an alleged illegal adoption scheme involving Marshallese women whose children Peterson arranged to be adopted. The case has led to a variety of legal questions, not only in terms of Peterson's case, but also the women involved. And joining us now to explain some of what could happen next is former U.S. Attorney for Arizona, Dennis Burke, now an attorney with Ballard Spahr. Dennis, good morning.
Good morning.
So logistically, and I guess legally, what does it mean now that Peterson is in federal custody as opposed to state custody?
Well, it's not uncommon for an individual in an investigation to be subject to the federal system and the state system at the same time. These investigations can percolate up from agencies at both levels. What happened on Friday was that the federal government went in, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Arkansas, with a writ. And now Peterson's going to have to appear in Arkansas. And whether he comes back to Arizona is a decision that's going to have to be made at a later stage now by the prosecutors in Arizona because of the steps that are going to be taken now at the federal level.
So would that have all been arranged ahead of time? Like, would the authorities in Arizona and Utah have known that this was going to happen ahead of time?
Usually, yes. Why I pause on that is that the federal government came in with a writ on Friday. And so they might have done that just to make the process, to accelerate the process, but also is a little perplexing in the sense of it's a little strong arm by the federal government as to taking first stabs at moving forward on the prosecution of Peterson.
And for us non-lawyers, let's define our terms. When you say they came in with a writ, what exactly does that mean?
Well, they actually had a document that they went to a federal judge and made their case that Peterson should be brought into the federal system, that they had an indictment against him in the Western District of Arkansas, and that they can, with a writ, they can go into a state court or a state jail and say that individual that's in your jail, regardless of what charges he or she has against him or her in state court, we're taking him now, and he's going into the federal system.
Does this give us any kind of indication in terms of which charges prosecutors believe are more serious or easier to prove, anything like that?
Yes. Usually the reason why something like this happens is that the federal and state prosecutors have been working together and have come to some agreement that who will go first and where that individual will be prosecuted first. Now, there's a whole host of reasons why that might happen. One in particular is the individual has speedy trial rights. And because of that, the federal government might want to be moving as quickly as possible because the defendant can drive that and say, I want the trial to occur now with the tactical reasons as to thinking that the federal government's not ready. It could be for witnesses' reasons. It could be for their ability to prove the case and what matters they have in their jurisdiction that are provable and can more effectuate prosecution.
So is it safe to say then that Peterson will in all likelihood be facing the Arkansas charges first before the Arizona charges, Utah charges, any other charges?
That's very likely. The fact that the federal government came in with a writ, the fact that he's going to now be moved to Arkansas surely indicates that they'll move on him there unless there's just some kind of agreement in Arkansas to then bring him back to Arizona. But that I would think that's very unlikely. I think the steps that were taken on Friday indicates that the federal government's going to move first on Peterson in Arkansas.
Now, legally, we know that it's really, really, really difficult, if not impossible, for example, the County Board of Supervisors to kick him out or force him to leave. Once he starts standing trial in Arkansas, are there state laws that preclude somebody from serving office while they are the subject of a legal proceeding like this? Or does the fact that he's going to Arkansas to stand for these charges, does that in any way help folks who want him to leave office?
I think it makes him a better political argument, but his position is no different than today than it will be when he goes to trial in Arkansas, which is these are allegations by the federal government. The federal government has an obligation to prove them, and until they prove them, he's presumed innocent. But the fact that it's moving forward and he is a political official makes it much more challenging to believe that he's going to be able to stay in office.
All right. That's Dennis Burke, former U.S. attorney for Arizona, now with the firm Ballard Spahr. Dennis, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
State economists are out with a rosy forecast for the state in the next fiscal year, projecting nearly $700 million as lawmakers get set to bargain over a budget in the fast-approaching 2020 legislative session. That number relies on the state's strong economy, punctuated by growth in state revenues and higher-than-expected tax revenue. The latest projection from the Joint Legislative Budget Committee on Friday depends on the economy staying strong against the unexpected, both financially and politically speaking. Joining us for a few minutes is economist Jim Rounds of Rounds Consulting. Jim, good morning.
Good morning.
So a lot of money to do certain things with. What are the options there?
Well, we have to be careful because the JLBC identified that some of the money is one time. So it's not something that they would count as occurring over each of the next 2 or 3 years. But they still have about $170 million in ongoing that they want to add. But overall, the state's doing well in terms of economic growth. These revenues should continue for a couple more years. And I'm kind of hoping that we get back to investing in some of the economic fundamentals. Like, I'd like to see a little bit more money go towards higher ed. I'd like to see a little bit more funding go towards some health industry development, things of that nature.
Well, Jim, what will make those happen then? Are you looking for more cooperation at the legislative level? Is this something you want to hear the governor talk about as we get closer to January?
Well, the governor's done a great job in setting up this economic foundation that's producing these revenues. We have a competitive tax structure. We're on solid footing as far as regulations go. We're probably going to be able to advance our tech industries much more than we did in the past. But we have to make sure that we keep up on workforce. So workforce is really the theme that's the number one driver for economic growth, high quality economic growth in different states. And that's what's going to make us competitive. So it's economic fundamentals, but it's also getting policymakers up to speed on how some of this works. And if you can get a good return on investment for taxpayers.
What makes the most sense to you overall, Jim? Because we know we're going to hear the argument from some that, okay, we don't know when the next recession is going to come. We need to sock away some money. Obviously, the governor's, one of his goals in the last session was to make sure we had a certain level in the rainy day fund. What's the balancing point you want to see? You mentioned investment. Are you also going to see, though, some lawmakers being cautious? And would you actually caution against too much caution?
I guess somewhere in the middle. I'm more bullish on the state than I've ever been, I think. I think we're going to weather the economic downturn very well compared to what we did last time. Where in the past, unlike in 2008, we always outperformed the U.S. and we should be in position to do that again and continue to be a top five state, maybe even better in all the economic categories. As a supporter of the $1 billion going into the budget stabilization fund, because you need a lot more than that for an economic downturn. So we're in good footing there. We've been growing the economy. I would like to see one of the things that I really like to see was when the Board of Regents released its budget request, and it was very economic and ROI driven. It was about workforce. It wasn't just about a general item. It was about a business plan. I've seen the healthcare industry is looking at the same kind of things. We have to think in terms of return on investment. We can't just spend without justifying to the taxpayer where we spend the money on, but we also have to be open to spending on those areas that maybe we haven't been investing as much in the past.
Is this a time to be innovative, considering that the next recession is going to be around the corner at some point? Is this the right time to start some of that investment and start coming up with newer ideas?
This is the exact time that you'd want to do that. In fact, I think we're going to have the best economic expansion that we've ever had in the 2020s. But part of that is dependent on continuing the current economic and fiscal themes that we've already set up, this foundation. but also being a little bit more aggressive in some of these economic fundamentals. For some reason, people in the past have talked about, say, university investment as maybe a more of a left-leaning topic. This is basic to economics. Most fundamental topic in economics is increasing productivity, and that increases people's quality of life. How do you do that? You educate folks, and you have a highly efficient capital. So again, we're talking economic fundamentals. So this is the time to do it. And we're going to have huge returns in the 2020s if we do this right.
And Jim, finally, you know a lot about what goes on at the Capitol. So we're going into a legislative session. It's an election year as well. Do you think that makes people more amenable to compromise or less so?
It's difficult to say. I think when it comes to spending in certain areas, I think as long as you have the right kind of message, that's been the difficult part in the past. You have to message it properly. You have to treat things as we're investing in the economy. We're going to have this kind of a return. We're going to have these exact programs implemented. We have to change how we message and how we create policy. I think that's just as important.
Jim Rounds, economist at Rounds Consulting. Jim, thanks.
Thank you.
The acting head of the Bureau of Land Management, recently reappointed, has been a controversial choice to lead the agency. In the past, William Perry Pendley has argued against federal ownership of public lands and has questioned the established science on climate change. As an attorney, he repeatedly sued the federal government. Pendley spoke at a conference for environmental journalists in Colorado on Friday. KJZZ's Brett Jaspers was there. He is here now. Hey, Brett.
Hi.
So let's start with climate change. How did Pendley address questions about the effects of climate change on public lands?
Well, journalists asked him over and over what he thinks the effects of climate change are on public lands, and Pendley repeatedly said his personal views aren't relevant, and that Interior Secretary David Bernhardt has acknowledged that climate change is real and human-caused.
Although Bernhardt also last spring said he, quote, hadn't lost any sleep, end quote, over carbon emissions in the U.S.
Right. So there are these ambiguities in rhetoric while the administration is opening up more land to fossil fuel development. Let me play you a clip that demonstrates how Pendley handled the climate change question. Here's Montana journalist Amy Martin asking him about the draft environmental impact statement for proposed drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's about a minute of tape, but worth hearing.
In the response to the comments on the draft EIS on the leasing program for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the BLM responded to comments, concerns about climate change, saying there is no climate crisis. So which is it? Is there a climate crisis? Is it human caused or not?
Yeah, I read that comment too. But that does not overwhelm the hundreds and hundreds of pages that were spent discussing in a very real scientific way that issue.
But it does speak to the discrepancy that we're trying to solve here. So because I agree, there's lots of talk about climate change in that draft EIS.
That's right.
But that comment undermines everything that said. So which one is
it? I don't think it undermines it at all. What is it, two sentences?
Two
sentences overwhelms
hundreds
of pages? I disagree. Right. And when we make a decision on that, I can tell you what will guide our opinion and our decision. It won't be those two sentences. It'll be hundreds of pages spent on it and a hard look at that issue.
Pendley also said he hadn't been briefed yet on climate change from his department's experts.
All right. So, Brett, did he have anything specific to say about Arizona?
Two particular things to Arizona came up: the reduction in the Bears Ears National Monument in southeastern Utah and the moratorium on new mining claims near the Grand Canyon. Pendley says he's recused from both of those things and he couldn't comment. Pendley, you know, some people may know that he spent about 30 years as head of the conservative legal group, the Mountain States Legal Foundation. And so he may be recused from making decisions on a long list of issues that come before the Bureau of Land Management.
Well, did he reveal anything about his plans or approach as head of BLM?
Well, he made clear that he thinks environmental reviews for projects under the National Environmental Policy Act should happen relatively quickly. This NEPA process is what the government uses to evaluate how a project would affect the environment, and it's where agencies take public comments on a particular proposal. Here's what Pendley said about NEPA.
I believe that NEPA is essentially where projects go to die. I mean, we have an obligation to do NEPA, but the American public deserves an answer. It deserves a timely answer. In other words, should we be doing an EIS on one project for 10 years or 5 years or 3 years? How long should it take? Secretary Bernhardt came in and said, let's cut the time it takes to get these things done so people have answers.
And environmental groups are saying that these reviews under NEPA are happening really quickly. The proposal to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is one example.
All right, that's KJZZ's Brett Jaspers. Thanks, Brett.
You're welcome.
And on this Monday, you are listening to The Show.
How a city is built strongly influences how much water that city uses. That's among the findings of new research looking at the relationship between the built environment and water usage. The researchers looked at four cities, Phoenix, Salt Lake City, Austin, Texas, and Portland, Oregon. In three of those four cities, having higher density single-family homes meant less water used. Philip Stoker is an assistant professor of landscape architecture and urban planning at the U of A and worked on this project. He joins me. And Philip, why do you think it is that higher density would lead to lower water usage?
It's hard to explain exactly why, but it could be a factor of the smaller lot sizes, smaller irrigated turf grass in some of these cities, and that all requires less water.
Now, when you look at a city like Phoenix, which is one of the four that you all looked at, Phoenix and density are not always two words that go together. There are certainly parts of the valley that do have density, but there are large parts of the city that are not dense. In those areas, are there ways that the built environment can be changed or manipulated to try to decrease water usage?
Absolutely. And land cover has a large role to play. So it's intuitive, but turf grass requires more water than, say, xeriscaped landscaping. And so we do see in Phoenix that higher density is associated with lower water use.
I'm wondering how easy or difficult it is, beyond things like landscaping, to change some of the things that the built environment that a city might already have if you're looking to decrease water usage.
Sure, it's challenging in areas that are already built up, but I think these findings are very important for new development that will take place in the cities.
So it sounds like you're hoping that developers and city leaders and planners will look at this and say, okay, not so much for the areas that we already have, but for new projects coming online, here are some maybe best practices for ways that we can not use quite so much water.
Exactly. But there is opportunity for cities that are already built up because there can be modifications to, say, zoning ordinances or overlay zones in portions of the city that would encourage some of these changes over time that would likely have benefits for water conservation.
So what are some of the things that planners and developers should be looking at then if they're looking to build the kind of places that people want to be while also trying to decrease water use?
The best thing that the land use planners and developers can do is collaborate more with water managers. And I see this research as a good evidentiary base to promote better coordination between land use planning and water management.
What kind of collaboration would you be looking for, and what kind of results coming out of that would you hope for?
Some collaboration could be when new developments are planned. The land use planners, the developers, and the water managers all come together to look at how that development will take place, how water efficient it can be, and then we'll work together to develop strategies so that new development can take place, but it's just more water efficient than sprawling neighborhoods of turf grass.
I'm wondering about the importance of things inside of buildings, things like showers and toilets and faucets and things like that. I would imagine that the choices that folks make in terms of what kinds of appliances like that to put in a home or a building make a big difference as well.
Those do. But one thing that we found surprising in our data was that we found that newer households in each of these cities were associated with higher water use. And so these newer households likely had the best appliances and the most water-efficient appliances, but they were still using more water. And so in addition to the appliances, I think a person's attitudes and conservation ethic also has a role to play.
So that sounds like it's less a conversation between developers and city planners and more between maybe water managers and the people living or working in those places.
I think it's an all of the above approach. I think there's a role for behavioral changes, but then what this research is showing is what a strong influence the built environment has on water use. So for example, in Austin, Texas, with just five measures of the built environment, we were explaining about 85% of all the variation in water use in that city during that year.
Were the findings consistent among the four cities? Like, did you find, for example, that bigger lots in Phoenix saw larger water use, and you saw the same thing in the other three cities? And was that similar for the other findings as well?
With some characteristics, we found that it was the same in each of the cities, but we did see some differences. An example of a consistent finding was the more vegetated cover on a property, which tended to be turf grass, was associated with higher water use. We saw differences in the effect of housing density and lot size between the different cities.
When we're talking about water conservation broadly, obviously there was a lot of discussion in Arizona about the Colorado River and the drought contingency plan. Not as much talk about household use of water. I'm wondering from your perspective where that fits into the overall conversation, especially in the West and the Southwest, about water.
Most water generally goes to agriculture, and this is true in most parts of the world. However, there's more and more people living in cities, and cities are growing, and urban populations across the West are growing. So thinking about saving water in urban environments is as important as making improvements in irrigation and agriculture and trying to allocate our scarce water resources.
All right. That's Philip Stoker, an assistant professor of landscape architecture and urban planning at the University of Arizona. Philip, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Last Friday, the director of the state's Department of Water Resources gave some bad news to Pinal County farmers, developers, and residents. State officials estimate there will be a shortfall of water in the region to the tune of 8.1 million acre-feet of water over the next 100 years. KJZZ's Ben Giles was at the legislative committee hearing in Casa Grande, where the state's water director, Tom Buschotsky, broke the news. All right, Ben, that seems like a lot. What exactly does the shortfall mean for Pinal County?
So I should start by saying we're not talking exclusively about Pinal County. The county is part of what's called the larger Pinal Active Management Area. That's one of five regions in Arizona where state officials have to monitor the health of groundwater. And the State Department of Water Resources, to do that, they report on the health of the aquifer under the land by looking at the 100-year water supply. So this time around, they used some new methodology to do that. And in the past few months, they analyzed the health of the aquifer. And the analysis they conduct, it isn't just a matter of how much water is there. They also try to anticipate how much water is needed. So that's the shortfall. It's the difference between how much groundwater there is and how much they anticipate is going to be needed in Pinal County.
All right. So when you talk about the water that's going to be used, what exactly are they looking at there?
Well, that was actually a point of contention, particularly from some farmers. The critics of the model said it assumes too much water is actually going to be used. There were farmers who testified to lawmakers that Friday that farmers actually use much less water than they're allocated. They have grandfathered water rights. And the state has to use the grandfathered water rights, not necessarily what's actually being used. The farmers say in a given year, we can use two-thirds to half of what we're actually allocated. So that was one point that maybe we're not going to need as much as you say. Buschotsky did say, though, that the newer model does account for farmers getting more efficient with their water use. So there is that over time, they expect the use, the need will go down. But it's not just agriculture. There's tribal lands in the Pinal region, and there's developers who are trying to build new homes, and they're not happy about this news.
Right. Speaking of developers, how could this affect the building of new homes there?
Well, so to build, you have to prove that you have a viable 100-year water source. That means that for the next 100 years, you can guarantee a home is going to have water to use there, and also that you can replenish the source as you use that water. If you are actively applying to build, this is terrible news for you because essentially they're saying, no, there's not going to be a 100-year water source. The one thing Buschotsky did say, he wanted to make clear, you get certificates, so to speak, that show you will have a 100-year water source. Buschotsky said, if you have a certificate right now, you're good. You can build. But if you had a pending application, they're reaching out to developers to try and work out what to do next.
So to what extent was there any discussion on how to solve this shortfall, if there's a possibility there?
Well, they didn't get into that too much, but fundamentally, there's two things you can do. You can reduce the amount of water you're going to use, or you can go out and try and find a new source of water. And that's not something that Buschotsky was really getting into any detail. He was just talking about the problem. How to fix it is something that he thinks should be left to local officials in Pinal County. So there weren't a lot of answers discussed at this meeting. So while Buschotsky says this should be a local issue, Representative Noel Campbell of Prescott actually had a different idea, rope in Governor Doug Ducey.
We can sit here and talk till hell freezes over, and we won't get anything done. We just won't. I mean, I'm not pessimist about it. That's just the political beast here. So it takes leadership. It takes somebody to crack some heads. You don't make an omelet without cracking eggs.
Ducey is the one that Campbell wants cracking heads, so to speak, I guess. And Campbell was just really stressed about the gravity of the situation. And I think he wants somebody big, somebody like the governor of Arizona, to step in and say, here's what we need to do to fix this long term. Otherwise, as he said, we can, you know, talk all day and we're not going to get anything done. Representative David Cook, though, he heads this ad hoc committee that's working on Pinal water issues. He tried to strike a bit more of a somber tone and just said, you know, look, it's good that we know this. We know what the problem is now, and we can't fix the problem unless we know what the problem is.
All right. KJZZ's Ben Giles. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
This is the show here on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Now we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a weekly segment where we talk about current issues facing the state and the nation, featured in columns on the newspaper's op-ed pages. Talk show host Ellen DeGeneres was spotted sitting next to and talking with former President George W. Bush at a Dallas Cowboys game earlier this month. The two seem to be getting along well, which some observers thought was a good thing, as DeGeneres and Bush are generally on different sides politically. But others, including actor Mark Ruffalo, were offended by the pairing. Phil Boas, editorial board director for the Arizona Republic, wrote a column about that and is here for his weekly appearance. So, Phil, is this a problem because we're in the extra-polarized age of Trump, or is there more to it?
Yeah, I think this is an important story. This is, you look at it and it looks like a little spat between celebrities, but it's stories like this about the culture that we work things out by talking about it and arguing about it. And you basically had one celebrity looking at another, keeping company with conservatives and being appalled by that. And so I thought that was worthy of a column and worthy of a discussion today.
Yeah. Well, Ellen's been around for a long time. It's certainly over the last decade, let's say. She has cemented herself as kind of America's sweetheart. She does a program that's light, that she has people from all different points of view and tries to have people get along. So it seemed like that was in character for her to then say, okay, here's this person who maybe I disagreed with politically, but I like personally, right?
Right. It's kind of interesting that in these times, to be kind and considerate takes a bit of courage because you're going to take a backlash, and she took a huge backlash for it. A lot of it came from the left, from the gay community that thought that she shouldn't be spending time with a president who didn't support gay marriage. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the Bush family in recent years, they're very much like the McCain family. They have been signaling that they're making their peace with gay marriage, and have members of the family have come out and been supportive of it, like Laura Bush, mm-hmm. like Cindy McCain or Meghan McCain.
So you're a conservative, so I'll ask this advisedly, but is it okay for people left or right to change their minds on an issue? Maybe President Bush hasn't. But for Ellen DeGeneres, is it okay for her to just like him as a person without agreeing or disagreeing with him? Or could she even say, well, he did believe that, but as he's gotten more educated, maybe he doesn't believe that anymore?
So Mark Ruffalo's objection to her mingling with the Bush family, and especially George W. Bush, is he believes, and he said this in his tweet, he believes that George W. Bush is a war criminal, that he needs to be brought to justice for what he did with the Iraq War. And that's just pure folly coming from a guy who supported Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in their general elections. Barack Obama, there are a number of people on the left who believe that Barack Obama is a war criminal because of the drone strikes he ordered in Afghanistan and in the Middle East that they claim were extrajudicial killings of people, you know, suspected of terrorism, who killed a lot of civilians because of that. But it overlooks the fact that we're in a very tough conflict with asymmetric enemies who hide behind innocent civilians. It's not an easy thing, and all presidents who deal with it are dealing with something in which they're going to make mistakes.
Well, again, that points to the tribalism we've talked about, that we can always justify who we support. Mark Ruffalo, there's a mention in your column about how he was doing a play, the Obamas came backstage, they got along really well. So it also could be where he just, and maybe George Bush is just a nicer guy as Barack Obama, but he doesn't like his politics.
Right. Well, there was a writer for Salon magazine, an online liberal publication, who's making the argument that what Obama did was actually worse than what Bush did. And Ruffalo tweeted that out. You know, it sent it out in a favorable way to his followers. And then years later, he's posing with Barack Obama in a photograph. So why was it okay for him to be friends with Barack Obama, but Ellen must shun George W. Bush? Don't understand it. All I can say is it must be snobbery that Ellen is mingling with a conservative, and he didn't like that.
It strikes me that a lot of people are going to say, here we go again. Why are we paying so much attention to celebrities or stars? It could be snobbery. How much can we as regular people relate to it? Because is your point that it makes sense for us to cross the aisle to talk to people who disagree with us? Or on a bigger point, is it that these people who are celebrities are on a different plane than we are?
Because it has been an argument that has been happening with average folks. You know, think of the discussion about Thanksgiving dinner with the relatives, you know, in the Trump era. I mean, Mark Ruffalo was making an argument for separatism, political separatism, and that is wrong in America. We don't do that. We shouldn't do it. We've done more of it in the Trump era, but we have to stop it because we've seen what tribalism does to this country. We've seen the rise of Trump because of all the tribalism in this country. It's not good for the country, and so we have to fight against it. Ellen is doing a good deed and actually making a powerful statement with what she did in befriending the Bush family. Mm-hmm. Maybe the Bushes were sending a signal, you know, where they spent their Sunday afternoon with Ellen DeGeneres and her wife, you know, in the GOP heart of Texas. Okay, is that sending a signal? Are the Bushes saying something? That ought to be thought about, too.
Phil Boas is editorial director of the Arizona Republic.
The world of aerospace has traditionally been male-dominated, but there are signs that may be changing. The first woman is taking the helm at Arizona's Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott, and she's doing it at a time when the school's female student body is going up. Annette Carlson is a Swedish national who has spent her career in mechanical and aerospace engineering for Saab Missiles and Saab Aerospace, and later for Sweden's embassy in Washington, D.C. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her recently and asked her if it means anything to her that she's the first woman in this role.
Yeah, exactly. I've been the first woman in almost all my positions.
Right.
So in one way, it's nothing new for me to be the first. Now, what's very interesting here is that there hasn't really been an issue that I am the first woman. I haven't gotten any pushback. Some of my previous positions, I gotten feedbacks like, well, you just got this position because you're a woman and they needed a woman. There has been nothing at all like that here. So I think the fact that the student body here is approaching about a 30% women student, that you reach almost like a critical mass. So even though it is still unusual with women in aerospace, aviation, we reached a critical mass, and that makes it much more welcoming for the women students and apparently administrators as well.
Yeah. So do you want to focus on continuing to expand that kind of diversity?
Sure. I think we still need to increase the number of women. This should be 51%, right? Isn't that what the number of women are in the population?
Right. How do you go about doing that? I mean, like you said, there's a point at which you reach a critical mass and it becomes easier for women, young women, to envision themselves in this field. But do you think that there are specific things you want to do?
So there are a couple of things that I think we need to do, and it is a long-term project. We do need to make sure that high school students, middle school students understand what we do as engineers, as aviators, any type of STEM education. Sometimes there is a perception on what we do that's not correct. So we still need to go out and tell students how exciting careers they can have. But we also need to work with the parents. I think a lot of times parents feel that these fields are not for women. And it's not that they don't think their daughter can do it. It's more that they think, oh, it's not a friendly environment for a woman to be a pilot or to be an engineer. So they discourage their daughters. And then thirdly, a lot of times the high school counselors just don't know either. So if you have a woman who is capable of studying engineering or aviation or any type of STEM fields, they encourage them instead to go in to become maybe a doctor or some other type of profession, which are great professions, of course. But I don't think they encourage them to go into STEM fields at the same rate.
Embry-Riddle is also growing in general, right? Like, it's graduated its largest class last year. Do you want to continue to expand it?
We will probably continue to grow, maybe not at the rate that we've been growing. I think we doubled over the last 10 years. Wow. So I don't think we will double over the next 10 years, but I definitely think we will continue to grow. We have a lot of new programs coming online, and that will attract a lot of students. So I can see our student body increasing maybe more at the rate of 50% in 10 years or so.
As you're approaching this role and figuring out how you want to, you know, tackle those priorities and grow the programs, how do you think that the aerospace engineering world is changing? Like, what do you think is next in this field that you want your students to be prepared for?
The big change is really the what we call the human-machine interaction. Today, computers are a big part of what we do, and that launches into how do you interact with a machine as a human, and how do you keep your device safe from hackers or other intrusions. Mm-hmm. So we need to make sure all students are intelligent when it comes to working with intelligent machines.
It's almost like a paradigm shift.
It is. And the good thing is that the new generation of students coming in, they are much more computer savvy than I am. they grew up with computers. I mean, the students that are starting college this year, they don't know a world without smartphones or computers. So they are ready for that. We have to make sure we're ready to educate them to leverage upon that.
Yeah. All right. That is Annette Carlson, the first female chancellor of Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University here in Prescott. Annette, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much.
Welcome back to the show here on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. The phrase "make America great again" isn't one that's accompanied by much neutrality. Basically, you love it or you hate it, and those feelings are typically lined up with whether or not you're a supporter of President Trump. But even acknowledging that, what does it really mean, or what is it supposed to mean? For ASU Dean Jonathan Capel, it opened up an opportunity for discussion and figuring out what Americans actually agree and disagree about. It's part of his series American Greatness, which has been featured on the web and in the Arizona Republic. And Capel is with me to talk about what he thinks and what he's learned. Jonathan, how much did Make America Great Again put you on the track to figure out about America's greatness?
The funny thing is, for all of the yelling back and forth about it, whether you're angered by red hats or whatever, nobody really says what they mean by it, right? So Make America Great Again, now they're saying Keep America Great. So something changed within 2 years. I mean, obviously from the president changed. So is that all they meant? I mean, I think most people think American greatness is more than who happens to occupy the White House. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think the country fundamentally changed within 2 years. So what do you mean by that? And if America was great, when? When was it great? How did you know when it was great? And as frustrating to me as people saying, make America great again, is the people who responded very angrily and said, ah, how dare you? America is great. It's always been great. It's like, well, what do you mean by that?
And Jonathan, the focus so often seems to be on what are the things we disagree about?
Moreover, we focus on, within an issue area, the ways in which we disagree. So I think it's not just articulating the things that we agree upon so we can sit around a campfire and sing Kumbaya. Like, that's nice. But I actually think if you start by articulating the common ground, that's actually a pathway to find some common ground on issues that divide us and seem like it's impossible to reach any agreement on. So it's not just, oh, this makes us feel better about the country. That's important, by the way. Mm-hmm. And that I can sit with my neighbor and not say, I hate you because you voted this way or that.
Right.
It's actually a pathway to find more agreement on stuff that we are having a hard time, you know, overcoming the divide.
One issue that seems like it should be something that brings us together that has been especially divisive lately is immigration. Most of us have come from somewhere else, our ancestors did. Is that an issue that we should try to find common ground on more readily?
Absolutely. And I talk about that in a couple of the pieces, that part of American greatness relative to other countries in the world is how we've handled immigration over the years. And that has been an incredible asset for our country, that we've been able to have people come into this country and they become part of the whole. And the interesting thing is that the country has changed as new people have come, and our culture has changed and our attitudes have changed. And we found this balance between consistency and certain values, but also integrating new people. And if we were to really focus on, well, how has that been key to our success as a country? That's a perfect example of how we might actually find our way to a solution on the current impasse. So the answer isn't no immigration and foreigners are bad and this is America. That's never been part of this country. It's also the case that unlimited immigration and immigration without any expectation of people adapting to American culture, processes, and values, that's also never been part of the success of this country. So this isn't about choosing one side and saying, yep, that's the side that's right. That's the side that's consistent with American history. It's about figuring out what's made us successful thus far, and where is there space in the current disagreement to continue that legacy.
Now, you're a leader in higher education. As America has seen itself as a leader on the global stage, it made me think about almost that we became a follower, that we looked at China or looked at other nations and said, well, you know, we have to compete against China. That's the phrase we always heard. Did that get us away from some of the things that America does better than anyone else? Does that sort of take away, with a de-emphasis on civics or a de-emphasis on what made our country unique, was that troublesome in some ways? And did that almost get people befuddled about, well, what's making America great? Is it that we're going to out-test them? Or because we do have to compete, but can we compete with them on a level that makes us great or unique as it has for centuries?
Well, I think there's a couple of different things embedded in what you just said, Steve. So first of all, I think part of what we have confused about our greatness are the results, not the causes, right? So we say, well, of course we're the greatest. We've got the biggest economy and we've got the biggest military and you know, we create, you know, the entertainment and the movies that everybody wants to see and everybody wants to come to America. And we have this entrepreneurship and we have the best universities and people come to study here from all over the world. All of those are true and they are powerful indicators of American greatness, but it forces us to say, well, wait a second, that can't be why we're great, because weren't we great before we were all those things? And so the question is, how did we get there? Mm-hmm. And so my argument that I've laid out in these series of essays are all about, in some ways, the building blocks that got us there, right? So this emphasis on creating opportunity, this emphasis on having individual rights protected, but also situated within a strong community, this emphasis on having a robust market where people can take bets on themselves and start a business, but it's managed by a government setting the rules of the game that are fair and not about advantaging one set of people over another. All of these features of American society is what got us to where we are. So the problem, to go to your point about testing, the problem there is it's focusing on the end, not on the building block.
Jonathan, one important word that has come up for a long time, even more so now, is diversity. And when it comes to civics and getting people to be on the same page of whatever they deem, we talk about the process of making America great, is there a thing there as well to make it clear that regardless of the color of your skin, regardless of how you made it to this country, we are all sort of trying to be on the same path as far as greatness goes?
So not only do I not see it as problematic that we have a history which is far from perfect, I actually see it as one of the most powerful statements about American greatness. And here's why. Mm-hmm. What makes America great is our aspiration for greatness rather than a sort of chest-beating self-assuredness that we've got it all figured out. Mm-hmm. The reality is we've articulated ideals since day one, since before day one, but we've never fully lived up to those ideals. We've been deeply flawed from day one. So when we speak about that, does that mean that all of that was a lie and it was a myth and we're all hypocrites? No. It means that we articulated a set of ideals and we didn't live up to them. What's most moving to me about this country, and I really do, I feel it emotionally, is that African Americans, Native Americans, Japanese Americans, people who have suffered from the flaws in our country over its history, they can embrace the ideals just as vociferously and just as passionately as those who have been on the other end. That's an amazing thing. The power of American greatness is that we're always working towards the realization of those goals.
Jonathan Capel is dean of the Watts College at ASU. We've been talking about his series on American greatness. Great to talk with you. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Welcome back to the show here on KJZZ in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up this hour, why some nonprofits are struggling despite big donations.
And efforts continue to preserve the San Pedro riparian area in southern Arizona.
But first, the situation in northern Syria continues to evolve quickly as Syrian forces have arrived in the region in an effort to hold off on an offensive from neighboring Turkey. Joining me now for our weekly look at some of the biggest international stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. And Rob, how big of a story does it seem like this will be this week?
Well, yes, Mark. I mean, this is a story that's going on right now, as you say, but how could it not be a major international story in the coming week? It certainly will be. So right now, Syrian government troops have moved rapidly to confront the Turkish incursion into northern Syria. Remember, the Kurds were left on their own with the US withdrawal of troops. So the Kurds turned to the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad in Damascus and basically said, help us. He's responded by doing so, by sending his forces to the northern border with Turkey to try and confront this Turkish invasion. That's the word we're seeing at the moment. Until this moment, Turkey has been in the ascendancy. For the last few days, it's driving its troops into northeastern Syria to clear out the Kurds. Remember, Turkey says these Kurds are allied with the PKK, who've led an insurgency inside Turkey for many years. So the Turks see the Kurds as terrorists. And the Turks are intent on creating a safe zone along their border, they say, 30 kilometers into Syria, which will keep Turkish communities out of the range of Kurdish guns and will allow for the return of some of the 3 million plus Syrians living on Turkish soil. Now, with the arrival of the Syrian army, things are getting very different. Remember, the Syrians are backed militarily by the Russians. So if the Russians get involved in all this, we have a war between Russia and Turkey, which is a fellow NATO country along with the United States. That's why we should keep this week, we should keep a very sharp eye on this story.
All right, Rob, let's move a little bit closer to home, at least for you. And we are, of course, getting used to hearing about big weeks for Brexit. Is there another one ahead for us this week?
Sorry, Mark, there's another one ahead. Britain, as you know, is set to leave the EU at the end of this month, October 31st. The government of Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the UK will leave on that day with or without a divorce deal with the EU. But of course, many regard such a deal as extremely important. It would allow for an orderly and managed departure from the EU. If Britain leaves without a deal, many think that would have pretty devastating effects on the UK economy, certainly in the short term. So the game is to get a deal. But this week represents the very last throw of the dice before October the 31st to do so. And that's because on Thursday and Friday of this week, there's a crucial EU summit. The EU says it'll engage in talks to get a deal until the eve of that summit, which is Wednesday evening. So effectively, the two sides have until Wednesday evening of this week to strike a divorce deal. Both of them, the UK and the EU, say concessions are being made, particularly over the central sticking point, the Irish border.
So, Rob, what if a plan is agreed to in time?
Well, if a plan is agreed in time, Mark, the UK government says it'll introduce a withdrawal agreement bill into the British Parliament, which will be voted on in a special sitting of Parliament this coming Saturday. That's been called Super Saturday. We heard from a veteran politics watcher here in Britain a few hours ago, Kevin Maguire of Britain's Daily Mirror newspaper. So what does he think will happen in Parliament on Super Saturday?
The Saturday sitting of the House of Commons Parliament, which will be the first since 1982 in the Falklands War, of course, Boris Johnson was hoping to be able to put a deal to it to avoid having to seek an extension. That's very unlikely. I think he will want a symbolic vote on his negotiations. But what he is worried about is opposition MPs, who collectively now have a majority, will put forward a proposal to have a fresh referendum on Brexit. He's called a Saturday sitting, but it could backfire on him.
It could backfire on him, Mark. So if a deal is not agreed, or a deal is agreed but not passed in Parliament, or indeed by all 28 members of the EU, as it needs to be, well, what then? Well, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's obliged by law to ask the EU for a further extension of this whole Brexit process to the end of January. But he says he won't do that. He would rather leave without a deal at all. So that begs the question, if no deal is arrived at this week, will Boris Johnson try and find a way of circumventing the law so that Britain can leave without a deal at the end of October? You can see the chaos of Brexit is still with us.
All right, Rob. Finally, closer to home for us, in Canada, a general election is looming. What's the latest there?
Well, compared to the U.S., Canada has a reputation for predictable and stable politics, but this election campaign has been quite a ride. So Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who leads the incumbent Liberal Party, was forced to apologize, if you remember, after photos and video emerged of him in brown and black face makeup. In those apologies, he said he'd acted wrongly and that he was merely expressing the failures of his privileged upbringing, which was an interesting one. Meanwhile, his main opponent, Andrew Scheer of the Conservative Party, well, he was revealed to be a dual Canadian and US citizen, as his father was born in the US. He's since said he's in the process of renouncing his US citizenship.
So aside from these sort of personal stories, have there also been big policy issues in this race?
Well, it's funny how often we're caught up with these personal stories. But yeah, let's just put those to one side, look at the policy. Well, one of the main issues that has been in the balance is environmental concerns versus energy production. So Canada, of course, is a big producer of fossil fuels, and the pipelines to move them to the US, for instance. Mr. Trudeau has instituted a carbon tax on various provinces as part of the effort to meet Canada's obligations under the Paris Climate Accord. But that's not popular at all with portions of the country that rely on those oil and gas industries. So let's see. We'll be watching those parliamentary elections, the general election, next Monday with some interest.
All right. That's the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. Rob, as always, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening this morning. We're covering Arizona and national news on the program. Let's review the latest developments in D.C. with WNYC's Tanzina Vega.
The impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump continues for a fourth week in Washington. And so far, the White House has decided not to play ball. Last Tuesday, White House counsel Pat Cipollone submitted a letter to the House of Representatives calling the impeachment inquiry unconstitutional and saying that the administration would not participate. The New York Times called the White House's position one of the, quote, most extraordinary assertions of executive authority in modern times. At campaign rallies in Minnesota and Louisiana last week, 2020 presidential candidate Trump took his usual shots at his political opponents and had this to say about the inquiry.
The radical Democrats' policies are crazy, their politicians are corrupt, their candidates are terrible, and they know they can't win on election day, so they're pursuing an illegal, invalid, and unconstitutional bullshit impeachment.
Despite the president's feelings about the inquiry, a federal district court in Washington, D.C. dealt him another blow when they upheld a subpoena from the House Committee on Oversight and Reform seeking his financial records. And finally, Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's personal lawyer, may be under investigation by federal prosecutors in Manhattan for his dealings in Ukraine. With us today is Michael Scheer, a White House correspondent for The New York Times. Michael, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, happy to do it, always.
We also have Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. Anita, thank you for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
And Keith Whittington is a professor of politics at Princeton University. Keith, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with you, Keith. How unprecedented is it for the White House to send a letter saying they will not be coordinating with the House on their impeachment inquiry?
It's pretty extraordinary. On the one hand, you wouldn't expect the White House to be totally enthusiastic about helping out the impeachment process, and so you expect them to be a little resistant. But the tone of that letter, the kind of arguments it stakes out are really very extreme, and the efforts that the White House engages in to try to dictate to the House how exactly an impeachment inquiry ought to proceed are really far out of bounds of what the White House ought to expect is within its own prerogatives and really interferes with how the House runs its own business.
Anita, haven't we seen this before? I mean, when Attorney General William Barr was held in contempt for defying congressional subpoenas, remind us again what happened then.
Yeah, I actually wasn't really that surprised by the letter. So remember, when the Democrats took control of the House in January, we have seen now months and months of them asking for things, subpoena documents, asking people to testify. And the White House has said no repeatedly for all different kinds of people and all different kinds of documents. So it wasn't that surprising, particularly because of that, and also because the letter, though an eight-page letter from a lawyer, sounded a lot like President Trump's tweets, a lot like what he says on a regular basis about how he's not going to cooperate. And it didn't quite say witch hunt, but it was very much the same tone. And so seeing it in paper was a little bit jarring, but the message has been the same message since January.
And Michael, this isn't, as we've said, the first time this administration has refused to cooperate with similar demands. State Department Secretary Mike Pompeo sent a letter earlier this month to Congress, also refusing to comply. Is there anything that makes this letter from the White House different from any of these incidents that we've just laid out?
Well, I mean, I think the things that we've already talked about here, the scope really was the thing that made it different. The White House, the past White Houses have always asserted its their prerogative to keep certain conversations between the president and his advisors or certain documents private. And they do that on the grounds of executive privilege by saying that is a function that is solely reserved to the executive branch, and that without privacy, the president couldn't do his or her job. The problem with the letter that Pat Cipollone sent, it was that it essentially asserted that Article 1 of the Constitution, which gives the power of impeachment process to Congress, essentially was invalid. I mean, the letter essentially argues that Congress had no right to even conduct an investigation and to demand any of this information, which I think most people viewed more as a political statement and a political argument than a legal one. And I think that's why most legal experts that look at it think that, while there is a role for role for the administration to argue that there are some things that have to be kept private, that it was really went way further than previous White Houses have gone.
And to that point, Michael, I mean, now that this letter is sort of a line drawn in the sand of many previous lines drawn in the sand, how do you think the House is going to proceed here?
Well, they've already telegraphed what they at least expect to do, which is to say, you know, the previous Congresses have just tried to litigate these questions, right? They've taken administrations to court. This Congress obviously has taken the Trump administration to court and said, no, you know, courts, please tell the administration they have to comply. The problem with that process is that it can take a long time. You get one court to agree, then you have to, the administration appeals, and ultimately it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. So what the Congress has said now is, we're going to take a different approach. By and large, when the administration refuses to comply, we are simply going to consider that to be obstruction of the impeachment inquiry, and we're going to add that to the list of charges from which we can create a set of impeachment criteria, and then move on. And that will deprive them potentially of some of the information that these documents and witnesses could provide. But I think they believe that that's worth it in order to keep the process moving quickly.
Keith, we hear the term constitutional crisis, at least under this administration, being batted about a lot. And I want to maybe stay away from that and ask you directly, is there anything in the Constitution that will prepare us for what we're seeing right now with the Trump administration's impeachment strategy?
Well, I think we're seeing an administration that's really trying to lay the groundwork for the Senate trial after an impeachment has already occurred in the House, and to some degree for the presidential campaign. The president seems to be conceding that the House is going to impeach him. There's still questions about what all the articles of impeachment are going to look like, but the president's strategy at this point seems to be to focus further down the road, try to make this into a political case, abandon the effort of trying to persuade the House not to actually pursue an impeachment. And then we'll see how well that strategy works out in the Senate and on the campaign trail. It's a particularly aggressive strategy. It offers very little for the Republicans in the Senate to grab hold of, because to the extent to which the White House simply wants to denounce the House's impeachment inquiry as invalid, unconstitutional, illegitimate, I think that's an approach that the Senate Republicans, for example, should be fairly reluctant to want to grab hold of. Instead, they would want to emphasize maybe the president has done some things, but they're not really that bad, and as a consequence, don't justify impeachment removal. Maybe there's some disputes about the underlying facts. But to claim that the House's efforts are simply illegitimate is an extreme claim that the Republicans in Congress ought to resist.
Michael, we've talked a lot about President Trump's rhetoric on this show, and I want to ask you, you've been covering Trump and his presidency since the beginning. Have you seen a change when it comes to his rhetoric, particularly at the rallies that he's been having?
Sure. I mean, it's hard to describe the early Trump rhetoric as somehow mild or not very intense, but even given that, I think we have seen a ramp up both in intensity and in frequency, both at the rallies where the speeches are going longer, they're more intense, he's using more fiery language, more aggressive language, and of course through his Twitter feed as well. He's tweeting significantly more in the last few months than he ever tweeted before, just in terms of the raw numbers. And the numbers of attacks are going up significantly. I mean, the personal directed attacks that increasingly are being directed at members of Congress, especially Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff, who is the Intelligence Committee chairman who's leading the impeachment inquiry. And I think none of that is an accident. I think all of that is designed, as we've sort of talked about already here, to invalidate the investigation. He is running the same playbook that he ran with the Mueller inquiry, which is to say, to try to invalidate the people and the information that is being arrayed against him, with the hopes that by the time we get to the end, people will see it as an invalid inquiry. And I think that's part of the timing situation on the Hill, where the lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers, are hoping to do this quickly to give him less time to complete that mission.
Anita, based off of what Michael was just saying, and in terms of whether or not the president's rhetoric has become more aggressive, particularly under this impeachment inquiry, you know, he mentioned that the president obviously is using a very similar playbook here. At the same time, polls are showing and have been showing for at least the past week that there's growing support for this inquiry among many Americans. Do you think, Anita, that there will be implications for Trump's aggressive rhetoric here on this, whether it's on his supporters? Will it just start to, you know, not matter much to people anymore?
Well, I've talked to a lot of people that are, you know, sort of prominent Republicans that are counseling him that talking about Ukraine and what's going on with that investigation is just not the same as Russia. These are a lot of people that support the president. They want him to win, but they are saying, look, when the Russia investigation was going on, we felt okay because we knew there was no there, right? There were different things that happened, but they felt confident that he himself, the president, hadn't done anything. But with Ukraine, not only has he made the call to the Ukraine president, he has admitted he made the call. He released a partial transcript or a rough transcript, and we have all this other information. So there was something that happened. The president claims he didn't do anything wrong. Other people say that it was something wrong. So it just feels like it's very different. In terms of the rhetoric, I feel like last week at these two rallies that you mentioned were almost as sort of the launch of the reelection campaign. Now, I know he launched several months ago at a different rally, but it felt really different to me. This feels like what we're going to see for the next 13 months. And I was talking to Trump supporters or seeing, you know, what they had said about the rallies, and they loved it. They loved that language. I'd add one thing to what Mike said, which is there were more curse words than I remember. He was, you know, swearing, and they loved every bit of it. These are rank and file supporters. These are people that go to the rallies. These are not people in Washington per se. So, you know, those people are going to love this. They are going to continue to be with him, I think. It's people that he's trying to get in swing districts. You know, remember he was in Minneapolis last week. That's a Democratic area, but he wants to win that state. He was very close. So it's people that are maybe on the fence. They're not going to like that, and that might turn them off. So it can help him in one way, but it hurt him in another.
Keith, are there any moments in U.S. political history that you find useful to think about right now, similar battles between a president and Congress?
Well, this clearly, I think, echoes the battles between the Reconstruction Congress and Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson, of course, was the first president to be impeached, and he found himself at odds with the Reconstruction Congress throughout his presidency. He had been vice president during the second term of Abraham Lincoln. When Lincoln was assassinated, Andrew Johnson rose to the presidency. Many thought he was certainly out of step with the Republican Party. Some saw him as illegitimate, and he tended to view the Congress as illegitimate. And so a lot of the Trump's rhetoric now, his stonewalling, his harsh political attacks on Congress, really do feel very reminiscent to the kinds of things that Andrew Johnson also tended to do to Congress and ultimately led into his impeachment.
Bringing it back up to today, Michael, the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is under potential investigation by Manhattan prosecutors. What do we know about that so far?
Well, look, the Rudy is being looked into because of allegations that he was involved in efforts to bring bring cash with Ukraine to the U.S., in a kind of scheme with two associates of his who he had who had connected him to a U.S. congressman that's not named in the indictment but is thought to be Pete Sessions. And all of that is not good for President Trump because it lends a sort of air of, criminality to what has up to this point been largely questions of political impropriety. And, there is no indication that President Trump necessarily was involved in some of that, but it doesn't help for the president's political fortunes as members of Congress dig into it all.
Michael Shear is White House correspondent for The New York Times. Anita Kumar is White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. And Keith Whittington is a professor of politics at Princeton University. Michael, Anita, and Keith, thanks to you all for joining us.
Thanks much.
Thank you.
And that's Tanzina Vega at The Takeaway. Good morning. You're listening to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Still ahead, the growth of Sierra Vista and Fort Huachuca in southern Arizona threaten the last free-flowing river in the American Southwest.
So both those cities draw all their water from groundwater. And so they are pulling down the aquifer, which really lowers the water in the San Pedro.
Coming up, conversation about the future of the San Pedro River.
But first, some charities across the country are struggling. That's the word from the head of the National Council of Nonprofits. Tim Delaney, the group's president and CEO, was in town recently for the Alliance of Arizona Nonprofits statewide conference, and I had the chance to catch up with him. I started the conversation by asking what he's seeing in terms of donations to nonprofits.
Well, it depends on who you're looking at giving. If you look at the overall aggregate numbers, charitable giving continues to go up in the United States, and it has for several decades. The challenge is that we have very wealthy individuals, billionaires, who are giving billion-dollar gifts, which is fantastic, and we should all applaud them and thank them for their generosity. But as they're giving all that money, it's masking the fact that regular households in America are actually giving less, and that they've been giving less over the last 16 years. And it got a lot worse this last year because of the change in the federal tax law.
It's interesting because you hear a lot about trying to sort of expand the base, right? It's great, as you say, to get some people giving a lot of money, but in many ways it seems like it would be better if a lot of people were maybe giving a little less, and on the aggregate it amounts to the same amount.
Absolutely. And the reason that that would be better, in my humble opinion, is that there would be a different allocation of the dollars. When the billionaires give their billions, they tend to give to the large institutions. Those large institutions, higher education, the huge hospital and healthcare networks, and again, those are worthy causes. But your everyday nonprofit, that's working in your local neighborhood, in your local city or county. They are suffering, and it has been very challenging for them.
Why do you think it is that fewer people are giving to charities?
Well, if you look at the fact that 40% of Americans live in poverty, if you look at the fact that over 42 million Americans right now are one paycheck away from going into poverty, there is harm that still exists. The talk about the economy growing and doing great things, it's great if you're on Wall Street, but if you are on Main Street, it's not as strong as it's being projected to be in the popular media.
What are you hearing from nonprofits around the country about some of the things that they are not able to do that maybe they have been able to do in the past or would like to be able to do, but just don't have the money available to meet those needs right now?
Well, what we've been seeing is since the Great Recession hit in 2007, 2008, it's been much more demanding on nonprofits as demands are going up. What do nonprofits do? They're mission-oriented. It's the mission and serving people above all else. So what do? They stop paying benefits to their employees. They don't give their employee raises. They don't pay for retirement for their employees. And they're hollowing out the organizations and their ability to continue into the future, all driven by this great need of compassion, of taking care of the people through their mission.
So how are nonprofits trying to adapt and maybe try different ways to raise money and convince people to donate?
There are several different approaches that individual nonprofits have. One of the things that we work on at the National Council of Nonprofits is working with our state associations of nonprofits, such as the Alliance of Arizona Nonprofits here in Arizona, that's been providing great leadership for nonprofits across the state. And so one of the things we try to do is bring nonprofits together, again, such as the Alliance of Arizona Nonprofits, with our conference, bringing in nonprofits from across the state to convene and learn from each other and exchange information so that they can go about advancing their own missions better without as much friction and being able to accomplish even more, and building relationships where they can then tag team and collaborate in providing various services.
Are you finding that nonprofits are using technology or other kinds of maybe non-traditional ways to try to get people to donate?
Certainly, there's as much innovation as can be done. Again, the use of technology requires resources. One of the things that nonprofits are is we're scrappy and we're innovative. If you want to look for innovation in America, turn to your nonprofits because they're finding ways to squeeze out the last little bit to accomplish all that much more. The other thing that we are doing is advocating more. We're realizing that our friends in government often are unaware of some of the policies that they're putting into place that make it much more difficult for nonprofits to advance our missions.
Let me ask you about something that you'd mentioned toward the beginning of the conversation, which is that we hear a lot about how the economy is doing well, and for some people that is certainly the case, but for others it is not. I'm wondering if it's possible to sort of gauge where the economy is, either nationally or maybe in a particular community, based on what you're seeing in the nonprofit world in terms of both the need for services and also the ability of nonprofits to meet that need.
I think that there is a way to look at it in terms of being a bellwether or the canary in the coal mine and recognizing where the pain points are and then trying to address them. Unfortunately, there's not been a lot of interest in looking at that and looking at people with greater need. And that's in part why nonprofits need to become better advocates. It's pointing out where the greater needs are so that resources, whether public, private, or donations, can be reallocated to meet those increasing needs.
All right. Tim Delaney is president and CEO of the National Council of Nonprofits. Tim, thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you, Mark.
It's the show here on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Climate change has been called the new normal by some, but residents in the Southwest say there's nothing normal about it. Communities in the Four Corners, where Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona meet, have been bouncing between desperately dry and record-breaking moisture for the past few years. Luke Runyon has more on how they're adapting.
Dustin Stein is pushing down the wires of an electric fence with his left foot while he swings his other leg over into a pasture. We're trying to get a closer look at his grazing black and brown steers.
The fence is on. Okay. This wire is not.
The 30-something mustachioed rancher lowers the fence just enough for me to straddle it. The dangling cables from my audio recorder barely make it over.
Watch that piece of wire there.
I've never been electrocuted through my recorder, so that would be a first.
Stein has managed Stubborn Farms outside the small town of Mancos in southwestern Colorado for the past 7 years.
So we're a sperm-to-steak grass-fed beef operation.
That's a new one.
You haven't heard that yet?
If you want a sense of what climate change is doing to agriculture in the Southwest, this is a pretty good place to see it on a small scale.
You know, so hot, so dry, so much snow, the river's too high. It's like, it's just incredibly bipolar.
The summer of 2018, for example, was the hottest on record across most of the Four Corners. With irrigation water tapped out and his pastures brown, Stein was forced to send all his cattle to high mountain pastures 200 miles to the north near Gunnison.
Because there was no way that we were going to be able to economically keep them fed here in the valley.
Then, this past winter, snowpack in some parts of the nearby San Juan Mountains was at its highest level ever, leaving parched communities having to quickly prepare for flooding. And before anyone could catch their breath, drought returned this summer.
I feel like I haven't had a break in, I don't know, 18 months or something.
Some scientists and practitioners have referred to this as climate whiplash.
Greg Garfin is a climatologist at the University of Arizona. For ranchers like Dustin Stein, he says climate change is not some far-off problem. It's affecting people now.
In the Southwest, we live in a very variable climate to begin with. And I think one of the concerns is about enhanced variation.
Meaning rising temperatures lead to less snow and lower rivers, which in turn limits which livelihoods can survive. There's lots of talk about adapting to a changing climate. But for small-scale farmers and ranchers, rearranging their operations is expensive.
You know, it's a cost. It's something you have to plan really for.
Carrie Padgett is a water engineer based in Durango. She points to irrigation. Much of that infrastructure was built almost a century ago. Both drought and flood have put big strains on their systems.
I think most people are living day to day in their operations, and they're not able to have that forethought to really save the money to plan for those future costs or replacements.
Okay, so that's kind of sub-irrigated, which is nice.
Back in Mancos, rancher Dustin Stein is thinking about how to make changes to his ranch to better mirror the erratic weather. Unlike some of the old-timers who ranch nearby, Stein will likely be around to see climate change reshape the Southwest.
We're literally on the edge of 14,000 foot mountains in between dry desert. And so I can see how that dry desert will slowly creep in towards us.
I think some people would look at you and be like, get out of there.
And some days I have those thoughts, but my heart is really here.
Plus, he says, there's something inspiring and exciting about being an early adapter, at least for now. Taking an historic livelihood like ranching and figuring out how to keep it going, even when it looks like all the cards are stacked against it. I'm Luke Runyon in Mancos, Colorado.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced in partnership with KUNC in Colorado, with financial support by the Walton Family Foundation.
The San Pedro River originates around 10 miles south of the U.S.-Mexico border and is the last free-flowing river in the American Southwest. Its unique ecosystem is home to hundreds of bird species and many mammals, reptiles, and amphibians. Its preservation has been considered vital over the past few decades, but as more people move nearby, the water source is being used more, leading to levels dropping and worries about the San Pedro's future increasing. Annette McGivney wrote about the San Pedro for Arizona Highways and is with me. So, Annette, how would you describe the San Pedro Riparian National Conservation Area?
It is a beautiful desert riparian area that flows unusually. It flows north, so it flows from Sonora, Mexico into southern Arizona, and it's lined with cottonwood and willow trees and lots of birds in the trees and bushes, and water flows over moss-covered rocks with little fish that you can see swimming around, and it's just like a little riparian paradise.
And about how many species of birds or reptiles are there?
There are something like more than 300 unique species of birds that visit there or live there. And then there's quite a few reptiles as well. For my story, I talked to one researcher who specifically studied lizards there because there's so many different lizards.
So it's the last free-flowing river in the American Southwest. How has that been able to remain the case?
I guess luck is part of it.
Yeah.
It may not stay that way, but it has been protected since 1988 by the Bureau of Land Management. It was designated as the San Pedro Riparian Conservation Area. Mm-hmm. So that has prevented dams from being built since 1988. Before that, it was private land and was actually like in bad shape for a while environmentally because of overgrazing. So since the Bureau of Land Management has taken over, it's been restored environmentally, and fortunately no dams have been built.
And what are some of the potential hazards or obstacles that may be coming its way?
So the biggest threat right now is development. The cities of Fort Huachuca and Sierra Vista have doubled in size since the San Pedro Riparian Conservation Area was designated in 1988. And so, you know, it's Sierra Vista has become a very popular retirement community, and then Fort Huachuca has grown with military personnel coming there. And so both those cities draw all their water from groundwater. And so they are pulling down the aquifer, which really lowers the water in the San Pedro. And they have recently installed some laws to try and minimize groundwater withdrawal, but it's still, the population keeps growing there, so it's still very much a threat to the San Pedro because the plants, the cottonwood and the willow, they can't take their roots, like keep going deeper. They draw from shallow water, and so they need that water table to stay high.
So as the population grows, do you have any indication that people who are coming in actually know enough about the San Pedro and actually care about it? I mean, other than those who are trying to keep it protected and preserve it, is there a feeling that there is respect for it and or not? Or is this more about just let's grow?
The feeling I got when I was down there hiking was that there is quite a bit of respect for the river and that people really are proud of the conservation area. And there's a very active organization called Friends of the San Pedro that's based in Sierra Vista. And so all these people that are retirees that moved to Sierra Vista, they seem very active in Friends of the San Pedro, and they are out there leading guided hikes, bird walks, and they are very proactive in trying to champion regulations that would protect the groundwater. But, you know, as you don't have to look around very far to see that real estate development and the money that it draws, it's hard to fight sometimes, you know, and so it's still very much of a threat, and I do probably think that there are plenty of people in Sierra Vista that depend on the growth of that economy and, you know, don't want to give that up for environmental protections.
Is there great concern that we're not just talking about drying up, we're talking about drying up at a pretty rapid rate?
Right. You know, it was maybe before they instituted these regulations within the last 5 years or so, there was a very dire threat to the San Pedro. It was literally like drying up. It was going away. And it was an emergency, and so these regulations were put in place. So it kind of held off that dire consequence of the river drying up completely, but it's still, the water table still goes down, and people I talked to with Friends of the San Pedro said that during certain times of year, sometimes the river does go away, and, you know, that does happen with desert rivers, but in the summer especially, you know, the water is not flowing in places where it used to. And so, you know, that is a concern. And I guess it's hard to think of a solution that would allow Sierra Vista to continue to grow at the rate that it does and not impact the San Pedro, because they have to, that's where they're getting their water. So all those people have to get water from somewhere. So I think that the ultimate solution would be they would need to draw their water from other sources. Like Phoenix obviously used to draw most of its water from groundwater, and that had really bad consequences, and then they started getting their water from a reservoir system, so that groundwater was no longer the single source for economic growth.
There's certainly concern, and even more especially over the last 3 years or so with the Trump administration and how the administration has acted when it comes to environmental issues. That concern has grown. I imagine it's grown in the case of San Pedro as well.
Right, definitely. You know, it used to be a heavily grazed area for cattle, and, you know, that was just for people in the region, ranchers, to make money. And then cattle were removed from the San Pedro, which allowed the San Pedro to recover, and it's just this lush oasis now. But if cattle were allowed to come back and graze the way they were before, it would definitely roll back all that environmental restoration. And so it's really important that we all advocate for conservation measures in places like the San Pedro instead of allowing resource users like grazing, mining, natural gas development, that all of that, you know, is takes a backseat to preserving the natural landscape.
All right, that is Annette McGivney. We're talking about her recent article for Arizona Highways about the San Pedro River and the Riparian National Conservation Area. Annette, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, Mark, there are a lot of things that remind me of Arizona, including the oppressive heat, the feeling of the monsoon, the view of a great sunset, and the smell of Harkins popcorn.
Well, Steve, now you can get Harkins popcorn whenever you want. The theater announced they're going to start selling 5 flavors of popcorn in local grocery stores.
You know, over the years, I have loved the experience of seeing a film on the big screen along with the popcorn. Yeah, there are a lot of good ones coming out, including The Irishman. So there's a wide variety of movies you can have this popcorn with. Yeah.
And, you know, if you want to gripe, it's not the same outside the theater. Dan Harkins has said they've been in the popcorn business as long as they have been in the movie theater business.
Well, that is an honest point. So do you have a go-to movie munchie?
So I am a big fan of Twizzlers, although you can't really get them here. I know my wife and I have this debate all the time, Twizzlers versus Red Vines. I think you and I have had this debate, actually, also,
yeah. For
all the candy you eat in life. I prefer Twizzlers, although Red Vines are an acceptable substitute.
Yeah, I used to eat Milk Duds. Now I just have water.
Junior Mints? You like Junior Mints?
Yeah, not at the movies. I'm no fun. You know that. I'm admitting this on radio. I'm no fun.
I disagree.
Yes.
You're very much fun.
All right, thanks.
A lot of fun.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.